welcome to VBAC Birth Stories, a podcast where Australians share their journey to a vaginal birth after cesarean.
We are a safe haven for women to share their own VBAC journeys and through these personal experiences, educate and empower listeners.
I'm your host, Mel.
And I'm your host, Steph. And this is VBAC Birth Stories.
Hi everyone. In today's episode, Steph and I meet Annalise, a midwife from the Gold Coast who is a mother to three children. Her primary cesarean was an emergency, following an induction at 41 weeks for being past her due date. She was led to believe that her childhood spinal surgery for scoliosis could have played a role in the way things unfolded in that birth. When she fell pregnant again, she was told an elective cesarean would be her safest option, so she proceeded with one. She experienced postnatal anxiety following this birth. After this, she became a qualified midwife and fell pregnant with her surprise third baby. Despite being diagnosed with insulin-dependent gestational diabetes and facing significant opposition from obstetricians, Annalise tells us of how her VBAC after two cesareans unfolded. Annalise's story really highlights the importance of balanced information sharing from healthcare professionals and of having knowledge and support as a pregnant woman, not only in the birth sphere, but in the challenges that come in that postpartum period as well, including breastfeeding. Annalise invites you to connect with her on Instagram if you have any questions after listening to this episode. Her handle is sprout.midwife. We'll pop this in the show notes for those interested. We're very grateful to Annalise for sharing her story with us. There is also a slight language warning on this one. We hope you enjoy this episode of VBAC Birth Stories. Thanks so much for joining us, Annalise. Would you like to start by telling us a little bit about yourself?
For sure. So I'm Annalise. Hello. I live on the sunny Gold Coast and I've got three beautiful kids. My daughter, Zana, is nearly 16, not quite there yet, thankfully. It gives me a little bit more time to prepare myself for that. My boy is 10. His name is Axel. And we were done after two, funnily enough. And then number three came along to surprise us. She's 2.5 and her name is Milo.
Before you had the kids, were you working as a midwife at that point?
No. So okay. I'm really showing my age here.
No.
I fell pregnant with number one. Very surprisingly, so I've actually had two surprises.
Yeah.
Only one of the three were planned. But yeah, look, I fell pregnant with Zana when I was 20, very, very early on in a relationship. So it was very unexpected.
Before that surprise, I guess, were you thinking at all about becoming a mother eventually? Or did you have any ideas in your mind about childbirth before that happened?
Absolutely. So I often, as a kid myself, as a young girl, when people would say to me, you know, what do you want to be when you grow up? I'd always say, I want to be a mum. That it was just something that was in me right from a very young age that I always just wanted to be a mum. But I suppose the only time I'd really thought hard about pregnancy and birth at all was when I was actually a teenager. I had quite bad scoliosis and when I was 15, I had major surgery to correct it. So that involved having two titanium rods put in my spine and a whole bunch of vertebrae fused together. So I remember, you know, thinking, and I asked the surgeon back then, you know, would this actually impact on my ability to carry a baby or birth a baby? And I was told, look, you know, it might give you a bit of issues during the pregnancy with some back pain and what have you. But yeah, I was told that it should not have an impact on my ability to give birth. So I was like, okay, that's cool.
At that time that you fell pregnant the first time, it was obviously a bit of a surprise. Did you have any sort of perinatal anxiety or thoughts about the birth?
Oh, look, I think with any first pregnancy, you know, there's a bit of anxiety, a bit of anticipation, a bit of, you know, all the questions, all the what ifs. I went to the classes, you know, did the education classes and read a book, you know, an old fashioned book with pages, you know,
back then. I remember those.
No apps or podcasts or anything like that. And I suppose I got towards the end and I was having just sort of GP shared care. So I'd mentioned about my back, my GP and the midwife that booked me in and no one seemed overly concerned about it impacting on my ability to birth. So I suppose I didn't really let it bother me too much either. And I got to the end and I thought, well, I've been able to carry this baby without too much drama. So I should just be able to give birth to it, right? That's just what women do.
Can you take us to your first birth and sort of what unraveled there?
like most first-time mums, I'd gotten to that pesky due date and it came and went. And so then, you know, there was the talk about induction and went through what the normal processes and all of that was. So I got to 41 weeks in a couple of days and came in for my induction. And I had the first dose of the gel, so the prostaglandin gel, got put up in the maternity ward. And again, back, you know, back those days, it was the ward with, I think it was four beds, you know, just separated by the curtains. And so I was in there with three women who had already had their babies, and I actually started contracting pretty soon after just that first lot of gel. So yeah, here I was just stuck in this room with three poor other women who are trying to sleep with their babies or feeding their babies, and here I am moaning and groaning in early labor. But it actually came on pretty thick and strong. The midwife came in and, oh no, this isn't labor, honey, you know, you just got a bit of an irritable uterus from the gel, you'll be right. Just a short while later, they did a check and I was 4 centimetres dilated, and they were like, oh, okay, hey, you've been doing a really good job in here. Yeah. So they took me back down to the birth suite and called my partner and my mum in, and I laboured for quite some time in the shower. I remember sitting on the exercise ball in the shower. Things just went pretty routinely up to a point where it all just got too much. I was just really struggling, and so I requested an epidural, and I was 8 centimeters. So look at me go.
Yeah.
So I had my epidural, and then everything just stopped, like it sometimes does with epidurals, you know, that mind-body connection, and you know, suddenly you're not in an upright position on the exercise ball in the shower anymore. You're on your back on the bed. So there I got stuck, my contractions stopped. They had to put up a drip with synthetic oxytocin to try and bring my contractions back. And every time I'd have a contraction, I could hear my baby's heart rate dropping. And I remember saying to the midwife, should this be happening? It doesn't really sound like this is good. And anyway, eventually it was declared that no, it wasn't good. My baby was in distress, and I'd been stuck at 8 centimetres, I think, for 4 hours. And so, yeah, in all honesty, I don't remember doctors coming in. I don't actually recall having a conversation or, you know, in questions or anything. I'm, as a midwife now, I'm all about really informed decision making, and informed consent is the bee in my bonnet. So thinking back, I'm like, yeah, I've got no recollection of anything like that. But, you know, I suppose like any woman, you know, who's best interest are in her baby's well-being, I probably just went, yep, look, it's got to be done, let's go, let's do it. Off to theatre, had a cesarean. Oh, I'll never ever forget when they pulled her out and lifted her up over that drape. I just remember thinking, oh, that's not right. I've seen babies being born in movies and things like that, and yeah, he just did not look right. So instead of trying to come out through like sort of the top part of her head like babies normally come out, she was trying to come out what technically we call an asynclitic brow presentation. So she was trying to come out through the left side of her forehead, essentially. So,
okay.
So her whole head was all out of shape. Her little nose was against her face. She, bless her, she looks fine now, by the way. So essentially that's why my labor stalled, because she was not presenting correctly for whatever reason. But the cesarean itself, I remember being shocked that I could actually feel things. You know, you sort of think, oh, cesarean, you're numb, you can't feel anything, right? Well, I could. It wasn't painful, but I could feel pushing and pulling and pressure and tugging, and felt like my insides were in a washing machine. And I remember being really shaky and nauseous, and I was crying the whole time. And then she came out looking like that.
And when she was born, were you able to have immediate contact with her, or what happened then?
So we did have a bit of a cuddle. They wrapped her up in towels and blankets and brought her over to me. I was, again, really shaky and just not feeling comfortable to really hold her. I don't recall skin to skin being offered at all. But afterwards, so once I was in recovery, the block from the epidural / spinal was actually rising. So rather than decreasing, it was actually rising and coming up to my chest. So they were quite concerned. I actually ended up spending about 4 hours in recovery. And back in those days, it was a matter of, okay, well, you're having problems. We're going to take your partner and your baby And they took her and him and with both of our mums, and they weighed her and they gave her a first bath and did all of that while I was stuck up in recovery. So essentially I ended up getting wheeled back up into the maternity ward and, got handed my baby, who was all fresh and clean and had been cuddled by everyone except for me. So I remember that being probably more distressing than the fact that I'd had a cesarean, was that, I'd missed out on that opportunity of bathing my baby and, all of that sort of stuff. So I'm glad now as a midwife that those practices have changed and that babies are kept with their mums, for as long as possible and not separated as much as possible. So, yeah.
After the birth, Annalise, how were you debriefed by the doctors about what happened, and did they give you any recommendations for future pregnancies?
I don't remember clear details about a debrief. I mean, I'm sure there was a conversation. In saying the term debrief, often it's not an actual debrief. It's just hi, how are you going? So you understand how everything happened and why it happened. Okay, all good. At some point in that sort of early postpartum period, I was told that it could have been because of my scoliosis, which really threw me, and I think that stayed with me for a very long time. It's still with me now. That, I'd gotten all the way through from having that surgery at 15 and carrying a baby and having this thought that, no, I'm still good. Like, this isn't going to completely wreck my life. To then suddenly being told that, because you've still got quite a significant curvature in your lower spine that does actually twist your pelvis a little bit, that maybe that's why she was trying to come out the way she was instead of being all nicely tucked in. She was malpresenting the way she was. So then suddenly I've got this cloud hanging over my head, like, okay, so my body screwed up giving me a crooked spine, and because of that, I screwed up being able to have a baby the normal way. And that just stuck with me for ages. I don't really remember whether they suggested that I would be suitable for VBAC or whether... Again, back 16 years ago, it was pretty much the mentality that once you had a Caesar, you would always be a Caesar. The evidence and the research around VBAC back then was limited, I suppose. So it may not have even really been something that they mentioned or discussed, during a debrief. These days they actually put it in the operation reports after a cesarean, whether, a woman's suitable for VBAC or not. But yeah, it was just that instantaneous, planting of that seed in my mind that, it's because of my screwed up body that I couldn't birth my baby, which is an awful feeling. And I lived with that for a very long time,
How did you cope postpartum?
I didn't really suffer from, any postnatal depression, maybe a bit of the baby blues, but no, I think I had lots of breastfeeding problems. She did caused lots of nipple damage, so I was expressing, and that just, it was just a huge mess, and I ended up putting her on the bottle by about 2 weeks. So I think, in that early sort of stage, it was, more trying to overcome all of those hurdles and navigate those waters than anything. But I think I transitioned into being a mum pretty well. I think it was something that I'd always wanted to do and be. So, suddenly I was a mum and I just loved it. I love being a mum, still do.
And so did you want to tell us now about your second pregnancy and how that came about?
Yeah, so again, it was the only planned one. So Zana was born to a previous relationship, and so when my current husband came along, we fell in love and we got married when I was 7 months pregnant with Axel, actually. And we met, we fell in love, we got engaged, we got married, we had a baby. The conversation around how this baby was going to be born happened pretty early on. Again, I was just having GP shared care during my pregnancy. Daniel, my hubby, didn't really have much to say about the way that this baby was going to be born. I wasn't a midwife yet at this point. Yeah, at first it had just been a conversation with my GP, and then, that initial booking in appointment at the hospital with the midwife. I don't really remember having a conversation about, you know, VBAC or not, or repeat cesarean. I knew that they were my options at that point, although I hadn't really done a lot of research into it. But then first meeting with the obstetrician was basically, yeah, these are your options. So, you know, repeat cesarean is going to be your safest option. Okay. Why is that? Well, vaginal birth, you've got a risk of your uterus rupturing, and with that comes the risk of you and your baby dying, essentially, was the take-home message from that conversation. And, you know, when you have that conversation and you're not otherwise well-informed and well-educated on the topic yourself, you just sort of walk away going, well, I don't want me and my baby to die, and his doctor is telling me that my safest option is a repeat cesarean, so that's what I'm better off doing, right? Like, you don't know what you don't know until you realize that you don't know it. And unfortunately, I didn't know it until I became a midwife, essentially. So, yeah, so I just, yeah, elected for a repeat cesarean, and that was that. As well as the fact, I suppose, it was that lingering doubt in the back of my mind that, well, if it was because of my scoliosis that caused the first birth to go the way it did I want a repeat of that? You know, did I want to go through another labour to have it end the same way if it was in fact due to because of my spine? So, and I suppose at that stage I was as at peace as I could be with that, thinking that I was making the right choice, yeah. Mm. And again, in the back of my mind I was like, well, this is a planned elective cesarean. It's going to be calm. It's going to be nice. It's going to be enjoyable. It's not going to be like last time where it was an emergency and it was all horrible and scary and yeah, but it wasn't.
Oh, how did it go, Annalise, the birth of your son?
Look, it was as calm and, you know, organized as an elective cesarean is, I suppose, but being that it was my husband's first time, you know, being in a birth, it was a whole new concept for him as well. And I'll never forget him saying to me afterwards, he said, I will never forget how you were in that operating theatre, because I was exactly the same as what I was with Zana. I was shaking, I was crying, I was just, yeah, it was awful. And I think it's just having had a couple of major back surgeries and a previous cesarean, I don't think any operation ever gets easier. I think there's always that fear in the back of your mind that something's going to go wrong, or, you know, that, like, you're laying on a table, you're being cut open while you're awake. Like, there's something terrifying about that concept. I know not all women feel the same way, but for me it's just a really, yeah, confronting and scary time to be laying on a table cold and exposed to 12 plus people in a room all staring at your body being cut open while you're laying there awake on a table. Like, it's just, yeah, it was scary. So it wasn't pleasant, it wasn't calm. But it was, as far as an elective cesarean goes, it was textbook. But for me, it was just a repeat nightmare.
Did you get skin to skin in the theatre with Axel this time?
Yeah, I did. It's great that we're able to facilitate that for women. But, you know, again, you're still lying on this table. You know, your arms are sort of out to the side with cannulas and drips and tubes and blood pressure monitors, and so it's awkward, you know, it's awkward to be in that position. So I suppose, yeah, absolutely did get skin to skin, but it's not really until you sort of go through to recovery and you're sort of sitting up a little bit more that it's at least a bit more comfortable to be in that position, yeah. But no, I was super happy about that, you know, he wasn't just whisked away the same way that Zana was, and that he stayed with us. That definitely made that part of the experience a lot better than last time, yeah.
And how was postpartum this time?
Breastfeeding problems, exactly the same with Zana. And look, it's everything to do with, you know, lack of knowledge, lack of information, lack of support, I suppose. But yeah, loads of nipple damage, ended up pumping and got to a point. I was actually expressing blood with the milk. And although Google said that it was okay for me to feed that to my baby, I was like, yeah, that's a no for me. And I ended up, you know, just tipping it down the sink. And I got to a point where I was a sobbing mess on my kitchen floor. And hubby just said to me, babe, look, this has to stop. You know, this is no good for anyone. And so yet again, after about 2 weeks, Axel was on the bottle. Then I actually did end up experiencing what was diagnosed as postnatal depression about 6 months later. In hindsight, knowing what I know now, I believe it was more postnatal anxiety, though, which is becoming a lot more understood these days. Because although, you know, I was obviously having very clear symptoms, they weren't depressive symptoms now. Like I was struggling to leave the house and everything was too much. But it wasn't because I was depressed. I was so worried about taking him out of the house because something bad would happen to him. So for me, that's more like an anxiety kind of symptom rather than a depressive sort of symptom. Now looking back, I probably didn't get the right treatment that I needed. You know, I wasn't medicated, but I do recall seeing, you know, a psychologist to talk through. But, you know, again, it's just becoming a lot more understood that there is a difference.
When did you decide, because you said that you became a midwife in between Axel and Milo's birth, what inspired you to go down this path, this career path?
Look, I'd always been interested in nursing. I wanted to help people, but in a way that wasn't sickness. I don't know if that makes sense. So I then thought about doing sort of psychology and helping people, you know, with their mental health. And then I suppose it was after I'd had Axel and I was in the maternity ward, there was a particular midwife who just really stuck with me in my heart, in my mind. She was just beautiful, always so happy and bubbly and so supportive and so reassuring and encouraging. And I just, that got me thinking. I was like, well, this is kind of cool. You know, I can do this. So when he was about a year old, I was looking into it. I was reading. I was like, oh my God, this is it. This is what I've spent the last 10 years figuring out what I want to do when I grow up.
So say when you became a midwife, did you learn a few things that made you reflect on your own birth experiences?
100%, 150%. Oh my goodness. Absolutely. I've spent days in a lecture theatre, you know, just with my heart hurting and even tears running down my face going, holy shit, like if I had known this stuff, you know, before either of those babies were born, like both of those births could have been so different, could have been completely not what they turned out to be. And not just here for so many reasons, not just because of my lack of knowledge at the time, my lack of information, but just lack of support, you know, from health professionals, you know, that lack of information sharing, that biased information sharing that I got and that women still get to this day. I see it every single day with these VBAC conversations that women are having with doctors. It's so one-sided. It's so biased. Mm-hmm. It's actually just that giving all the information, as I said, it's that bee in my bonnet, fully informed choice, fully informed decision-making. Women should be given all the information rather than just what that doctor perceived to be the important information. As I said, we weren't planning a third baby at all, but yeah, totally reflection on how different those births could have been had I been better informed, better supported. Absolutely.
So then after that point, were you feeling empowered with this new knowledge or were you feeling a little bit sad or angry about it? Where did you go from there?
Totally mixed emotions, yeah. And I suppose I thought, you know, I wasn't thinking, oh, well, when I have my next baby, because we weren't planning another one.
Yeah.
But it was, right, when I become a midwife, this is what
the practice,
absolutely.
And for you in that mind, was that a way of making your births right, in a way forging that path as a midwife and saying, okay, these were my birth experiences, but maybe I can support other women out there to have different birth experiences?
writing the wrongs.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I suppose I sort of went forward thinking, you know what, if I can support one woman to have a really positive VBAC at birth, or one woman just to feel empowered by having all the information, then that's, you know, that's going to make it right. It still totally hurt. I was still heartbroken that, you know, that I felt as though, you know, I was still harboring those feelings that, oh, it was because of my spine that I couldn't give birth, and it was because of, you know, the lack of information that I had the repeat Caesar instead.
So when you fell pregnant with Milo, that was a surprise. Did you know at this point you were going to be back?
After a couple of weeks of getting over the surprise of Milo. Yeah, 100%. Yeah. I don't think there was ever a question in my mind. And I think because I'd been so passionate about it since becoming a midwife that, look, I mean, you do have those, you know, those conversations in your head of, okay, so, you know, am I going to be supported? Am I going to be able to achieve this? Am I going to have to put my gloves on and fight for this? And I suppose it was always, well, they can't cut me open and do a cesarean without my permission. So, you know, I was willing to put my gloves on. I was willing to come to that fight and ring that bell. And I was fortunate enough to have a beautiful, supportive husband who trusted me, I suppose. And that's the biggest thing with all of this, you know, whether it's a VBAC or, you know, being a midwife or, you know, being a health professional, is just about trust. And he trusted that I knew what I was on about, that I knew, yeah, there was a risk, but it was a very small risk. I did utter the words home birth to him at one point. He did shut that down fairly quickly, and I went, okay, that's fine. No, he did. He trusted me, and I was lucky enough to be able to reach out to a beautiful, amazing midwife who I'd worked a lot with, first of all, as a student in the midwifery group practice. So I actually DM'd her and said, so don't suppose you've got much on around September? Like, she knew that we weren't planning more babies. She knew that that wasn't a thing. And
it sounds like a New Year's Eve baby.
Well, you know, Christmas, New Year. I had to get kind of like statistics right. And she just messaged back like, what do you mean for you? And I was like, uh-huh. And she's like, oh shit, yeah. And my story, she knew I'd had the two scissors, and she knew inherently that I was going to be wanting a VBAC, and she said, yep, let's do it. And so I had her support as well, which was incredible. I was really mindful to not overthink and to actually not sit down and actively think about what this birth was going to be. And look, I'm a bit of a hippie, let's be honest. And I literally just opened up my soul and my mind and my heart to the universe. And I actually just let thoughts and visions and feelings and just everything come to me, rather than actually sitting down and thinking and putting thoughts out there. I let them come to me. Not once did I ever feel as though this birth was going to be a cesarean. I just didn't. So I just trusted that, I guess. Yeah.
And this midwife, was she like hired as a private midwife, or was she just sort of a midwife in your hospital that was able to stick by you?
Yeah, so she was in the birth centre, so the midwifery group practice in the hospital that I work at, yeah.
And how were your appointments at the hospital? Did you have to meet with obstetricians during your pregnancy, and what were those appointments like?
They were fun. So the first appointment obviously was with my midwife and booking in, and again, she pretty much knew my history anyway. And so then the next appointment was with her and Daniel, my hubby, and the obstetrician. Basically, that conversation went, well, we're recommending that you have a repeat cesarean. And I said, yep, got that. And then he ducked out and consulted with his consultant, and he came back and said, well, the consultant has just said that we shouldn't be supporting you for a VBAC at all. And I went, cool, got that.
What was your immediate reaction to that? Did you just sort of dismiss that?
There may have been a very obvious eye roll. And I just thought, okay, like I expected this. You know, this is not upsetting. This is not surprising. Again, it was just in the back of my mind. These guys can't do a goddamn thing to me without my permission. So, And I suppose I've often said to women, how crazy is it that we actually have to have a consultation with an obstetrician to get consent for them to do nothing? Like we're actually asking them to do nothing for me. We're not going to them saying, doctor, I'd like you to cut me open and take my baby out. I'm actually going to them and saying, doctor, I would like you to do nothing for me.
I was going to ask you, actually, in your experience working as a midwife and in your sort of personal opinion, do you feel from what you see that obstetricians are more pro-caesarean? You feel as though that's often the default position? Or do you see a bit of both?
Look, I definitely see a bit of both. And this is where, look, to be honest, this is how I will actually explain things to women who are feeling a little bit confused, is that doctors are amazing at what they do. They're risk managers. They look at, you know, healthy, low risk, normal pregnant women are not going to see obstetricians. You know, only women who have some sort of complexity of varying degrees are going to see doctors. You know, otherwise, healthy, low risk, normal pregnant women are being looked after by midwives. That's our job. But as soon as they've got some sort of risk, that's when they go to the doctors. So that's their role, is to assess what a woman's risk is and to figure out what the best way to minimise that risk or to manage that risk. So for VBAC women, you know, the risk is uterine rupture. And so that's where they are thinking that the best way to minimise that risk of uterine rupture and maternal and fetal death is to do a caesarean section. So that makes sense. But for us as midwives, we look at everything else. You know, we look at all the things that a woman has got going for her. That's sort of where I go back to, you know, having that full conversation. Okay, yes, you've got these risks. Yes, you're 0.5 or whatever percentage risk of having that uterine scar rupture during labour. However, you're actually, if you're looking at the research and the statistics, you're actually at between sort of 60 to 80% success rate of having a successful VBAC. So that's what we as midwives look at. And that's where everyone has their part to play. You know, health professionals across the board, we've all got our part to play. And, you know, I'm definitely not, you know, I definitely don't think negatively about doctors at all because they're great at doing their job. But that's where I think a holistic approach in maternity care is so important because, yeah, we're not just looking at the risk. We're actually looking at the good, the healthy, the normal factors as well. And again, even further than the physical side of things, like let's look at women's mental health and emotional health and spiritual health. You know, it's not just about, yeah, the physical side of things. It should just be, you know, a holistic clinical picture of each woman and not women being pigeonholed into a box based purely on a guideline or a policy or what one research article says over another.
These appointments, did they talk about the risks of a repeat caesarean as well?
Yeah, there was that conversation, definitely. There was some conversation about the risks involved with labour ending up in an emergency caesarean rather than a planned, you know, elective caesarean without labour. Again, though, they don't talk about things like the benefits of labouring before a caesarean. And that was actually one of the conversations I had right at the end. So the first doctor was not supportive. We shouldn't be supporting this at all. The next couple of appointments were actually with the director of obstetrics. So, you know, I went to the top and actually had his support. He was actually on board. And I think it was because I could actually sit there and say, you know, and these doctors all knew that I was a midwife. I worked very, very closely with them. So I think it was because I was able to sit there and say, look, I know what my risks are. I don't need you to tell me what the statistics are of VBAC. But what I do know is that even if labour isn't successful in a vaginal birth, then there are benefits of labouring before a cesarean in regards to breastfeeding rates after having a baby, you know. So I was thinking even past the birth. I was thinking mentally, you know, I'd had the previous postnatal depression / anxiety. And I said to the very last doctor at one day past my due date, I said, look, I'm happy to have a cesarean if I absolutely have to. And he said to me, well, why not just have a cesarean? And I said, because of all the reasons I've just given you, you know, I know what the benefits are. I know what the risks are. I just want to at least have the opportunity to try. Look, there was all the conversations. Along the way, I also developed gestational diabetes.
Oh. So Mel's had personal experience with that as well.
Yes. And look, it was my first time. You know, I deal with GDM all the time as a midwife. I did not have a single risk factor for it. I think this was the universe saying, but Annalise, you're a midwife this time. You can deal with this so that you're a little bit more empathetic in the future. Honestly, like my glucose test results were next level, like absolutely next level. I've never seen numbers that high.
Wow.
DTT result. I was like,
it's interesting because a lot of women I know who've said that they had GD, they didn't actually present with any of those usual risk factors either. And they were really shocked about it.
Yeah.
And some of them tend to sort of be a little down about it initially. I'm not sure.
I think it's this connotation that, you know, as soon as you start talking diabetes, it's because you're unhealthy, right? You're overweight,
exercise. Or the assumption that you somehow caused this or was somehow in your power or something.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But, you know, the first thing that I'll often say to women, you know, especially these women without risk factors, is that it can at times be purely hormonal. And they say, well, heck, you know, you never read about that anywhere, do you? It's like the fact that one of your placental hormones works against insulin during pregnancy. So, you know, without any risk factors, it can purely be because of this hormone that your placenta is producing. As soon as you get rid of that pesky placenta, it's gone, you know. So, yeah, it really is. There's, yeah, a lot of negative connotations around gestational diabetes. But, yeah, I actually had to laugh after I cried for a really long time. I just had to laugh. I'm like, this is just bloody typical, isn't it? And it was so out of control, I ended up being on insulin for it, you know, which is not very common. But, you know, I was doing all the right things, made all the proper dietary changes. I was, you know, keeping myself healthy and fit and well. I ended up gaining 3 kilos in the pregnancy. Like that was, you know,
nothing.
But yeah, so, and I think the troubling thing for me was knowing that because I was an insulin dependent gestational diabetic, that was going to be a whole other 6 rounds to fight. You know, in this fight, I knew that they were going to be wanting to talk induction at 38, 39, 40 weeks. And they were. I agreed to serial growth scans at 32, 34, 36, 38 weeks that were all showing my baby was fine. There was absolutely no concerns about her getting too big. You know, the scans were perfect. And so when I went to see, again, the director at 38 weeks, and he said, right, so let's talk induction. I said, nope.
Annalise, were your blood sugar levels controlled with the insulin and the diet and exercise? Were they all showing up?
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. So once I was on the insulin, they were well controlled. But before then, yeah, it was all over the place. They just basically went straight from diagnosing it. I monitored for a week, I think. They didn't even talk medication. They just said, you straight onto the insulin.
The obstetrician that you saw knew that your blood sugar levels were well controlled with the insulin, but there still is a recommendation for induction just because you have gestational diabetes.
Yeah.
How did you feel and how did you respond to him?
Like any, you know, guideline or policy, you know, again, it's about not pigeonholing women into that policy just because that's what that policy says. You know, I understood, like, yeah, the risk of gestational diabetes, or some of the risks are that the baby can get too big or there can be too much fluid around bum. And because I was having these growth scans, that showed that everything was fine, you know, my argument to him was, why do we need to be inducing me? You know, my baby is fine. I am fine. My blood sugar levels now are fine that I'm on the insulin. You know, the growth scans are all normal. What is the absolute need for me to be induced? And he was fine with that. I think it's that, you know, when you sit down, you have these conversations with the doctors and you can actually show them that you know what the heck you're talking about, that they're actually happy to support and be on board with what you want. The worst thing is that not all women are well-informed enough or well-supported enough to be able to have those conversations and to be able to show the doctors that they know what they're talking about. Like I was in my first two pregnancies, you know, you just sort of go, oh, okay, you're a doctor, you're saying I should be induced at 38 weeks, cool, let's do it, you know what's best. But until, you know, women actually have all that information and that support and that grounded knowledge about why that recommendation's being made and the fact that you can actually dispute it and argue it and fight it and not be, you know, put into the guise of that policy, that you're actually your own entity with your own unique situation, that, you know, doctors are generally supportive for sure.
And it was interesting, he was bringing up induction with you as a VBAC potential mum.
That is very, very interesting. So again, one of the conversations that I'll always have about VBAC is that, you know, all of these risks double if you need to be induced. Being a VBAC after two previous cesareans, most of the discussion will be, well, we're not going to induce you because there's too much risk, you know, it's just not going to happen. However, that's where I was very, very lucky in being able to sit down, you know, with the head of obstetricians, and he actually hand wrote a page in my pregnancy health record that he was supportive. And yes, I signed the paperwork that said I was, you know, requesting care outside of medical recommendations or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. I was like, yep, I'll sign my name on that dotted line. He was even supportive of of me using the bath, which I just about fell off my chair. I thought, look, I'm really starting to push the boundaries now. But, well, why the hell not? And I said to him, so doctor, how do you feel about me using water immersion for pain relief in labour? And he just sort of, he sighed and leant back in his chair, and I thought, I'll jump in here. I said, the reason being is, you know, because I know the risks of VBAC, I know the risk is uterine rupture. I know that the signs of uterine rupture, the early signs of uterine rupture are pain. And if I've got an epidural and I can't feel pain, well, I would actually feel safer being unmedicated in water for pain relief, you know. So I was able to actually talk through my reasoning with him. So in the end, he went, yeah, okay, that's fine. I'll allow water immersion. He said, but probably hop out of the water to actually birth your baby. And I went, yep, sure. That was never going to happen. going back to production, one of his points that he wrote in my book was that he was happy for induction if need be, and to use oxytocin with caution was his wording, as in we'd use it very cautiously, we'd have, you know, monitoring and IV access and all of this sort of stuff, which I agreed to. And so I went forward going, okay, cool, so we've got a plan. I don't need to be induced at 38, 39 weeks. You know, they kept trying, but anyway, so that's when I got to the last doctor's appointment, was with another consultant, and at 40 plus one. And he said, right, so when are we having this baby? And I went, well, what do you think? And he goes, well, I think you've sort of, you know, you're insulin dependent diabetic, you know, you kind of need to be having this baby. And I'd got to the point where I thought, I've probably pushed the boundaries just about as far as I can. And I said, well, okay, so we're talking induction. And he goes, I will absolutely not use oxytocin. And I went, but the other doctor, you know, the guy that's actually above you, said that he would be happy to. And he goes, well, not on my watch. He said, you know, if he's on call, then that's fine. But any other doctor you'll find will not be supportive of using oxytocin for induction for you. I said to him, so what's the plan, doc? Like, if you're not wanting to use oxytocin, what's the plan? And he goes, well, we'll break your waters and we'll wait. And I said, cool. How long do we wait? And he didn't have an answer for me.
Had you had in your mind that you were wanting to go to a certain stage, or were you just sort of going with the flow and at that point in your pregnancy?
Yeah, totally going with the flow. As I said, I never really sort of allowed myself to think too much, to have a sort of a plan as such. And I suppose for me, it was like there was always this lingering thought in the back of my mind, like, you know, I've really pushed my limits, you know, like every step from, you know, right from the get-go, fighting for a VBAC after two Caesars, and then getting the gestational diabetes, and then starting the insulin, and then, you know, fighting the induction at 38, 39, 40 weeks. I just sort of thought, I'm like, I shouldn't really push it too much further. I don't know. I never really sort of had a limit to how far I was going to let myself go. And I don't know, I suppose I just put possibly an insane amount of trust into my body that it would actually just do what it was intended to do. And so, yeah, for the next couple of days, I was just mentally planning, I don't know, just putting everything out to the universe, like, come on, body, let's do this.
Did you do anything differently in terms of birth preparation this time?
Absolutely. You know, I was really trying to maximize my chances. So acupuncture, yes. Lots of positive affirmations. I didn't do hypnobirthing as far as hypnobirthing sort of courses, but I did sort of look into and did lots of meditation and things like that. Really positive visualization. I did all the natural labor preparations. So clary sage oil, evening primrose oil, no raspberry leaf tea, so that's obviously contraindicated in VBACs. Dates, pineapple, spicy food, nipple stimulation. If it's on the list, I did it, yeah.
So did you want to take us now to Milo's birth and what unfolded there?
So at that last doctor appointment, he was, you know, pretty strict on, okay, we need to get this baby out. So the midwife, forgot to mention, my midwife changed halfway through my pregnancy, which was pretty scary as well. So the midwife that I'd initially contacted and who started supporting me got seconded to a management position when I was about 27, 28 weeks. So that completely threw me for a six. Ended up being next best option. Like, honestly, this new midwife I'd worked very closely with, was very, very trusting. So yeah, basically at 40 plus three, we went up into the hospital. My birth plan involved having a team around me. Again, when I was allowing the universe to send me visuals and thoughts through the pregnancy, I only ever imagined birthing with my family around me. So it was my hubby and the two other kids. And I also had a beautiful midwife / friend / auntie who had actually been one of my university lecturers. She's this gorgeous New Zealand midwife. I just instinctively knew that she needed to be there as well. And I had a good friend who was actually there as our photographer. So it was a team job. And so, yeah, we went up there first thing in the morning. And because of all this amazing preparation I'd been doing, the midwife said I had the softest cervix in the world and was already 2 to 3 centimetres dilated even before labour. And so she broke my waters and I got dancing, I got on my ball, I, you know, did everything to try and get things cracking. And literally probably within an hour, I was in active labour. Surprised even myself. It just happened. I was having, you know, regular contractions. I didn't really remember what contractions felt like 13, 14 years ago at the time. I didn't really remember, but as soon as they started, I was like, oh, something's happening here. And yeah, so my midwife checked again after a couple of hours. The plan was because she knew I wanted to use the bath, the plan was to put the fetal scalp electrode, so the little clip onto Bubby's head to monitor the heart rate so that I could use the bath and keep a close eye on that heart rate. Because again, that's one of the early signs of uterine rupture is baby's heart rate goes through the roof. So I was happy for monitoring. I've had some midwife friends say to me, you know, why didn't you decline monitoring? And I said, well, because I didn't want to. I wanted to make sure that everything was fine, you know.
And I think it is it's a very personal decision, because then if you're happy with it, it's not throwing you off in the course of your labour. So
absolutely. Yeah. So yeah, my midwife, after a couple of hours, she did another examination to put the clip on, and I was 4 centimetres. So yeah, literally within an hour or two, I was, you know, she declared me to be in active labour. I spent most of my time either walking, sort of dancing around the room, or sitting on the exercise ball. My kids were beautiful. So Zana was just very quiet, observing from a distance. Axel was, oh my God, he's so cute. You know, rubbing my back and Yeah, and he was just interested. He was genuinely interested in what was happening. Anyway, I got to a point where I think I went into the bathroom for a wee, and the light was off, and I closed the door, and I ended up just staying in there for ages. And I think I always talk about staying in your baby, in your labor bubble, and the importance of not being distracted and not having to come out of your bubble to ask questions or to talk or things like that. So I think I went into the bathroom and it was pitch black. The door was closed. I think I knew inside me that things were, you know, really cracking on. As much as I wanted my kids to be there, I didn't want them to see me potentially, I don't know, I wasn't distressed. I was actually really quiet. I was strangely quiet. So normally, and I'm being very well behaved today, normally I swear like a sailor. So I actually thought that I was swearing a lot during my labor, but I didn't at all. I was very, very quiet. I was just focused, just working through each contraction and yeah, just sitting on the toilet. And I suppose as well, it removed the distraction of being able to hear the monitor as well. I didn't want to sort of be distracted by, you know, hearing the baby's heart rate on that monitor. So I just stayed in there, and like time disappears when you're in labor. So I have no idea how long I was in there for, but yeah, just rode those waves in there all by myself for a while. And then my midwife came in at some point, and she must have sensed that something was changing, and she knelt down and she's like, "So how are you going?" And I got into a point where I started to have just that, let that sneakiest little bit of doubt in. And I said to her, I need something. I said, I need something. Otherwise, yeah, this is not going to go to plan. And I said, I need the bath. Can I have the bath now? And she went, yep, which I'm so thankful for. A lot of midwives at that point would have said, well, why don't we just do an examination just to see where you're at? Eventually, I got in the bath, and I feel like I was only in there for a moment, but I think I must have been in there for maybe about an hour, and changing my positions and just, again, I'd never had a really distinct idea of what position I would be in labor or birth. I just was listening to my body. I found myself in an all fours position, was the most comfortable most of the time. Daniel just sat on the ball outside the bath, sort of supporting me from outside. And then, yeah, I got to a point where I had a contraction, and at the peak of the contraction, I pushed. I didn't mean to push. It just happened. And I, it just took me by surprise. And look, this is going to sound probably pretty crazy to most people, but I had that sensation to push. I had my eyes closed, my eyes flung open, and my face was sitting so close to the surface of the water that I saw a reflection of my eye. And I remember thinking, that's weird, I can only see one eye. And I believe now that I was actually seeing into my third eye. And just that, at that point of intense spiritual moment of actually realizing that, holy crap, I'm going to have a baby. Yeah, just this involuntary urge to push. And I said, wow. I don't know where Daniel was, but I just called out. Like, I said, babe, that one made me want to push. And he goes, all right, I'll get a midwife. And I remember Axel saying, there's no midwives in the room at the moment. Just outside the door having a chat between themselves. But yeah, I'll never forget that. Anyway, so the midwife came back in, and I just, that's when I really started doubting myself. I was thinking, it's too soon. Like, this can't be happening. I was just like, this can't be happening. And I just kept saying that to my midwife. I was like, it's too soon. It's not ready yet. Like, I was confused, and she was saying, what do you mean? Why do you think it's too soon? And I suppose in my mind, funny, as a midwife, you know, I talk to women all the time about what it's like to give birth, but having never actually given birth vaginally before, you know, I had this concept in my mind that at the point where you're starting to push is the same time when you're starting to feel that burning ring of fire that we call it. But I wasn't feeling that. I was just having the urge to push. And so that's what I was saying to her. In my mind, it was too soon. I was thinking, is the baby in a weird position? Am I having this early urge to push for some reason? Is posterior? I was just really, really doubting. But then every contraction that came after, I had that urge to push. My midwife said to me, she's like, no, you're showing some really positive signs back here, hun. Like, it's happening. And I couldn't believe it. It just happened all so quickly. I think even at one point I did a sneaky little vaginal examination myself just to sort of... Because there was no way I was getting out of that bath, right? And I was like, I had a feel and I was confused. I didn't really know what I was feeling, even though in hindsight, I was like, yeah, I was totally fully dilated and there was a head like right there. Eventually it just got to a point. I had a few contractions where I had that urge to push. The next one I had that burning sensation, that stinging. I said to Daniel, are you going to get in the bath, babe? And he goes, do you want me to get in the bath? I said, get in the bath. At one point the midwife said to me, she's like, oh, now, hon, it's probably a good time to hop out of the bath. Remember, we spoke with the doctor and you were going to hop out of the bath. I said, I'm not getting out of the bath. I think she knew the whole time as well. She had to say it, but she knew there was no chance I was getting out of the bath at that point. And I'll never forget as well just hearing Axel's little voice in the background, because when we see the baby's head, right, starting to appear during second stage, we always document that the presenting part is on view, right? But often as when documenting it, we write PP for presenting part. So my midwife had said to the second midwife who'd come in, PP on view. And I just remember Axel going, PP? That's all it did. And so as soon as I heard him say that, I knew it was happening. So that actually gave me, you know, real reassurance at that point. It seemed like, I think it was only a few contractions, maybe three or four contractions, and she was out. I scooped her up out of the water and I couldn't say anything except, oh my God. Like, I'm not a religious person, but I just couldn't stop saying, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. I think it was just, oh no, I was out of this world. It was crazy. Amazing. I remember it like it was yesterday. I'm tearing up.
Oh. And how did you feel with her on your chest in the bath?
I was shocked, I suppose, shocked and just surprised and amazing all at the same time. Unbelievable. Just couldn't believe it. I did start having a pretty brisk bleed straight away though. So, you know, my midwife sort of said, no, honey, you need to get out of the bath now. So we sort of had to rush through that kind of stage. So that was a little bit hairy. They got the bed over and I climbed out. That's when Zana got quite upset, because obviously blood in water looks like there's loads more than there probably is. But she just saw all this blood and she got really teary. And I was like, no, honey, it's okay. It's normal. But then even I started to think, oh, shit, is this too much? Got to do a little bit of delayed cord clamping, and then Axel cut the cord, which was beautiful.
It's nice, actually. We haven't heard a story yet of where the siblings are involved at all in the birth, or they're there. Do you think that gave them a special relationship with Milo in any way?
Yeah, absolutely. They're both amazing with her. Yeah, just all three of my kids just continuously amaze me and make me so proud and so in love every single day. And so it was just crazy. Like, when I was in the bath and, you know, in that pushing phase, it was like, he was on poo patrol. He's like, we've got poo over here.
I was going to ask you, actually, because, you know, the fetal ejection reflex, you know, you feel like you need to poo, right, when you're pushing. So, yeah, that's interesting. Yeah. So you did do it and they just scoop it out of the water with like a...
Exactly. And you know what? It's one of the biggest fears that women have. Probably the two biggest fears around labour and birth is, it's not even about the pain of labour. It's actually, women have fear of pooing in labour and the tearing that can happen, you know, and both are just so common. And like at the point that you, if you do sustain a tear, it's when you're literally, you're being stretched to your capacity. You've got that burning ring of fire. You're actually feeling so many sensations that you don't know whether you've torn or not. And yeah, and look, the pooing thing, look, you know, it's so normal and so common that as midwives, we don't give it a second thought. And most of the time, you know, without an Axel in the room declaring that there's poo over here, most midwives are very discreet and just scoop it away and clear it up, and you never know any different. So, yeah.
Speaking of tearing, Annalise, did you experience any tears?
Yeah, I had a second degree tear and, yeah, had to have some stitches around. So going back to the fact that I thought I would be swearing during my labour but didn't, that's where it came into play was during the stitching process, because my midwife had said to me, oh, look, yeah, you're going to need some stitches. Do you want to use the gas while I do them? Silly old me said, oh, look, I haven't used any drugs till now. Why start now? And so, yeah, that was when all the F-bombs came. I felt so bad. I swore so much at her. But, yeah, look, as I always say, they actually heal really, really well. I didn't have too much discomfort with it. You know, it stung for maybe a day, you know, while I weed. So I just, you know, used my water bottle. And, it, yeah, they really weren't a problem at all.
Placenta was okay, came out?
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, that came out. I had it encapsulated and took my placenta pills for a couple of months after.
How did you feel when you went home after this birth?
Oh, amazing. Absolutely amazing. So I would have been home early discharge 4 hours later, but they wanted to obviously monitor her blood sugar levels because of my diabetes. So, yeah, so I stayed in for, you know, 24 hours. And it was funny because I ended up saying to Daniel, look, you know, if shit hits the fan and I end up needing another cesarean, I said, you're going to need to be here at home with me for 6 weeks because I'm not going to be able to drive. You're going to need to do, you know, the school runs and the grocery trips and stuff like that. So he took 6 weeks off work. I think by the end of the first week, I was like, yeah, I'm fine. You can go back to work now. But yeah, no, it felt absolutely incredible. Just, yeah, physically, emotionally, just, yeah, everything was amazing. I was a new woman. It was literally like I'd been reborn myself.
I wanted to ask you, how did your breastfeeding journey go with Milo? Was it different?
My breastfeeding journey continues to this day.
Oh, congratulations.
Yes.
It was in the beginning, I felt that she, I think it was maybe around day two, I felt her starting to do a little bit of pinching, a little bit of not latching well at the breast. So again, just with the knowledge I've got and, you know, my experience now as a midwife, I took it upon myself to keep her off the breast for 24 hours and just hand expressed and gave her colostrum just via syringe feeding and rested my nipples and then, you know, relatched again after that. And from then on, it was fine. You know, the nipples were a little bit tender for a while, which is very, very common. They say that breastfeeding shouldn't hurt, which is true to some extent. But, you know, as I say to women, nipples are sensitive little bastards. Like, it's going to take a while for them to get used to being latched onto and having something sucking on them 24/7. So, you know, a little bit of tenderness. But, yeah, no, absolutely amazing. As I said, 2.5+ years on and she's still a booby monster.
But it is just so nice that you got to have that experience after your first two.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, for sure. And that was, you know, equally as important because, you know, again, since Anna was born, you know, I had all this doubt and, you know, to be honest, self-hate, lack of self-esteem, like really poor image of myself because I felt like my body was just a failure, you know, for all the reasons. You know, my back was screwed up, so that was why Zana couldn't be born, and that was the reason I had the repeat cesarean with Axel, and I couldn't breastfeed, so that was just another failure. So that's what I mean. Like after Milo's birth, it literally changed my life, and it's changed the way I look at myself as a woman. And 15 plus years of feeling like a failure is pretty crap to live with. Mm-hmm. To actually come out the other side of this and being able to look at myself in the mirror and look at my breasts and look at the massive scar I've got on my back and the scar I've got from my cesareans and actually look at it all and go, do you know what? This is all just made me who I am today. And it's just incredibly empowering the way that pregnancy can actually go on to, you know, make you feel every single day.
I wonder if there are women out there that are listening who have just had their second cesarean. Maybe they attempted VBAC, maybe they didn't. I know many of them don't particularly feel great about it. Yeah. Do you have anything to say to those women?
Look, I suppose the most important thing is that there's no right or wrong. There's no right answer. Again, there's not everyone is in the same boat. Some women are absolutely more than happy to have cesareans and just elect for a repeat cesarean, and that's totally okay. I've gained myself a bit of a reputation as, you know, a VBAC warrior, where all these women are hoping for a VBAC sort of get, you know, shuffled over my way to provide care for them. But, you know, I'm more than happy to support women planning an elective cesarean as well. You know, that's fine. It's not that just because I did it is what's right for everyone. And I suppose even if you are attempting a VBAC and it's not successful, it's actually about just finding within yourself, within your own heart and soul, what is going to be the right journey for you. And if fighting for a VBAC is what makes your heart beat, then do it. Have that drive, you know, put those gloves on and have that fight. If it's not successful, don't beat yourself up, you know. Actually take on that, you know, that you were powerful enough to have those conversations, to, you know, to stand up for what you believe is right. And, you know, and look at it as, you know, there's such crap terminology around all things. You know, I hate the term failure to progress, which is what, you know, Zana's birth was deemed at. It's like, it's not a failure. It's not a failed VBAC. It's, you know, it's actually that you were driven to get what you were hoping for, whether or not it's successful or not. Yeah, it can be heartbreaking in the end, but I suppose it's the journey. It's not just about the destination. It's about the journey to get there. I've put so many women onto, you know, this podcast because it's actually about, you know, knowing that there's lots of different journeys and there's loads of support available, and it's just about arming yourself with as much information as you can. If that information then drives your passion to get what you want, then fight for it. Because again, I know what those conversations are like in the rooms with those obstetricians. But nothing can be done to you, for you, to your baby, for your baby, without your fully informed consent.
Thank you so much for joining us today. And you've just made so many amazing points about the whole thing. Not just about your own experiences there, but just the system and how it works, and also your perspective as a midwife working in that environment and the things that happen there. Thank you so much for that.
Oh, thanks, guys. And yeah, look, I'm always more than willing to, you know, answer any questions. If anyone, feel free to add me on Instagram or, you know, whatever.
Thank you.
Yeah, more than happy to share, you know, any sort of any knowledge or wisdom or experience if anyone needs it. I'm an open book, and I'm super glad and honored to have been able to share my story through this amazing avenue that you guys have created. So thank you.
Thank you for listening to this VBAC story. If you like the show, please subscribe and feel free to leave a review. If you would like to connect with us on social media, you can find us on Instagram and Facebook. Just search for VBAC Birth Stories. If you have a question or you'd like to express interest in sharing your personal story, email us at vbacbirthstories@gmail.com. VBAC Birth Stories is a podcast where we share women's lived experiences. Please be advised that it's not intended to replace medical advice. If you have any concerns at all during your pregnancy, please always speak to your healthcare provider.